TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The World According to Trump, with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Chris Hedges gets the first take on the November 24 elections. Here are excerpts from an extraordinary 54-minute conversation on the current and future wars coming out of the transition from the Biden to the Trump administration. With his extensive insights and expertise into the Middle East and American foreign policy, Lawrence Wilkerson provides an understanding into what a Trump presidency may look like outside of the borders of America. It's hard to imagine two better matched partners in this conversation. Chris Hedges is a former war reporter for the New York Times. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson was a former war planner and chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Christopher Hedges is an American journalist, author, and Presbyterian minister. He reported for the New York Times from 1990 to 2005 and served as the Times Middle East Bureau Chief and Balkan Bureau Chief during the wars in the former Yugoslavia. Chris Hedges opens the conversation on his YouTube channel, The Chris Hedges Report, by introducing his guest.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, retired and former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, is a Vietnam War veteran who attended Airborne School, Ranger School, and the Naval War College, and who was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, logged over 1,000 hours on combat missions. He went on to serve as Deputy Director of the Marine Corps War College at Quantico, and was Executive Assistant to Admiral Stuart Ring, United States Navy Pacific Command, and Director of the United States Marine Corps War College. His disillusionment with the trajectory of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East followed the revelations of detainee abuse, the ineptitude of post-invasion planning for Iraq, and the secretive decision-making by the Bush administration that led to the invasion of Iraq. At a congressional hearing recorded on C-SPAN in June 2005, he gave his analysis of the Iraq War's motivation as, quote, "I use the acronym OIL," he said, "O for oil, I for Israel, and L for the logistical base necessary or deemed necessary by the so-called neocons, and it reeks through all their documents, the logistical base whereby the United States and Israel could dominate that area of the world." Wilkerson has said that the speech Colin Powell made before the United Nations on February 5th, 2003, which laid out a case for war with Iraq, included falsehoods of which he and Powell had never been made aware. "My participation in that presentation," he said, "at the UN constitutes the lowest point in my professional life. I participated in a hoax on the American people, the international community, and the United Nations and Security Council." He called the UN presentation probably the biggest mistake of my life. He has taught at the College of William and Mary and George Washington University. He's a senior fellow at the Eisenhower Media Network, a group of former military, intelligence, and civilian national security officials who describe themselves as offering an alternative analysis untainted by Pentagon or defense industry ties, and countering Washington's establishment narrative on most national security issues of the day. Joining me to discuss U.S. foreign policy, the conflicts raging in the Middle East, including the genocide in Gaza, the Ukraine, the fate of the American empire, and of course, the election of Donald Trump, is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Let's begin with the election and its effect. You saw the intelligence community, Milley, all sorts of figures essentially join the Democratic campaign in support of Kamala Harris. Let's talk about why Trump triggers such deep animus within the Pentagon and the intelligence community, and what you see happening during a second Trump administration.
I think the animus was created within my community anyway. I still call it that, the Pentagon, the military in general, because they don't see any concerted effort on his part to express a strategic appraisal that agrees with theirs. theirs being the one most parroted by the New York Times, for example, and others of their ilk, who are simply spokespersons for the military-industrial complex and for the national security state, which we have most assuredly become. And so they're worried about anyone who would come in and threaten to break the China. And that's what Trump, that's what his forte is threaten to break the China. And they're very protective of their China, just as are the national security agencies in general and the 16, I guess it's 16 now, entities that we have that are supposed to be our intelligence eyes and ears, led by the CIA. Not led by the DNI, because he still has no real power over the CIA, but led by the CIA. I would say Bill Burns is the most powerful guy in the United States with regard to intelligence and what goes to the White House and what doesn't go to the White House. So that's part of the reason. They just don't know this guy except from the first term, and the first term would not, through Kelly and Milley and other people's eyes, give you much hope if you were a Pentagon member of the bureaucracy, if you will. The second reason, I think, is because he's so mercurial, and the military doesn't like that at all. They like constancy, even if it's incorrect constancy. And I think that's a problem with them. And there's a third reason, too, and that is that they're worried about what I call Christian nationalism, some of them anyway. Others are aiding and abetting it. And what that means, in essence, is not just this far-flung but very ripe and alive effort by certain Christian groups in America to make Christianity the national religion, to change the Constitution in that effect, or to discard the Constitution with regard to religion. If you make Christianity the national religion and you do all the things that you would have to do constitutionally and otherwise, or just totally disregard the Constitution in that process, but you get, as we have just seen, probably enough Americans behind you to do it, then you have a whole different ballgame for the military, because the military then is called on, domestically and otherwise, and most Americans don't understand the domestic missions that the Army in particular, but the military in general, has to defend that. And they don't want to. They think that's fractious. They think that's unconstitutional. They think that's something that would cause more harm than good. And I'm glad to say that there are still some people like that left in my military.
Let's talk about Ukraine. I mean, Trump has deviated from the establishment consensus on Ukraine. I never understood, perhaps you can unpack it for me, the whole Ukraine policy, other than as a kind of proxy war to degrade the Russian military and isolate Putin. I was in East Germany when the Berlin Wall came down as a reporter. I was there when the promises were made to Gorbachev not to extend NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany. And of course, as you know, the Soviet Union had to acquiesce to the reunification of Germany, and that was the promise made. And then we kind of, I'm not defending the invasion, obviously, of Ukraine, but we certainly baited the Russians and Putin. But let's talk about Ukraine. I don't see how any military strategist seriously could think that in a war of attrition, the Ukrainians could dominate.
Let me say first, I was there too. I was special assistant to Chairman Powell, and the change that took place with the advent of Bill Clinton was absolutely disastrous. And I attribute to William Jefferson Clinton a lot of the problems we're living with today, including the violation, major violation, of that promise not to expand NATO. That's a longer story, better left for another time. I think what we're looking at in Ukraine vis-a-vis Trump, or Trump vis-a-vis Ukraine, is his, and I think Doug McGregor, for example, is right about this. I just watched him on Judge Napolitano's show, is his disdain for war. I think it's genuine. I don't think he likes war. I don't think he likes starting wars. I don't think he would be a president who, he'll go off and kill someone like the Iranian IRGC member or other people whom he's told are terrorists or whatever. But I don't think he wants war, quay war. And so he's willing to shut down Ukraine. Now, there's another reason, too. I think he detests NATO for different reasons than I. I don't like NATO much either. I think it's well beyond its sell-by date. And he sees NATO as being, and he's right in this, as big an aider and abettor, Brussels is, of the war in Ukraine as Washington is, led by that perfidious Albion, London. And so he wants to shut that down. And I think his ultimate goal is to not to abandon NATO perforce, but he wants to get the United States out of its relationship with NATO, which is, he thinks, we pay for everything, we do all the heavy lifting, they do very little, come back to the United States, as it were, and say, you've got our nuclear umbrella, but everything else you do, because we're not with you anymore. And, of course, save the money that that saves, too. I think it was part of his first term, and he just didn't get to do it the way he wanted to do it. So those, I think, are the major reasons that he will be positive with regard to Ukraine, because you're right. Ukraine is a disaster right now.
Yeah.
And most apparently for Ukraine, they're dying by the dozens every day now, and they have no people left. They're having difficulty. They're having to impress young people, bring them into the military to get them to fight. And they're lucky if they don't desert within the first week, because either going over to the Russians or running away wherever they can go. It's a disaster. We don't have generals in the Pentagon saying this. Now we have Lloyd Austin. He's right there with Joe Biden. But we don't have generals in the Pentagon, in my view anyway, who are expressing these kinds of views that generals on the outside are expressing, like David Petraeus and Barnes and other generals who are saying, well, Russia's losing. They're lying through their teeth. They're lying through their teeth. Either that or they're just stupid. So I think Trump would shut that down, and I'm looking forward to that. I hope he does. I hope he shuts it down forthwith.
Let's talk about the Middle East. What will be the difference between a Biden administration and a Trump administration vis-a-vis the genocide in Gaza, in Lebanon, and then this knife's edge we're sitting on between Israel and Iran?
I'm concerned about something happening between the time that this is all consolidated, which won't be long, apparently, and the inauguration and what the Biden administration does. I'm worried about what's going to happen, because I think Bibi is still intent, and firing Yoav Gallant was indicative of this par excellence. He's still intent on going after Iran, but he's intent on the United States going with him. And the force deployments that we've made, the force deployments we're making right now, the number of troops we're sending actually to Israel right now, indicates to me that we are cognizant of this fact. We might not be yet ready to go along with it, but we are cognizant of it to the point where we're putting the forces in place that we think will be necessary. I think we're wrong. I think we're going to get our rear ends handed to us if we do what Netanyahu wants to do with regard to Iran, which is a full bore war. We're going to find out how weak we are when we do it. If Iraq and Afghanistan weren't sufficient, this will certainly seal the deal. But I'm worried about this interim period and what the Biden administration might actually do in this interim period, not just to do what Bibi wants them to do and what I think Joe Biden is inclined to do, but to mess Trump up. I mean, what better way than to the inauguration takes place while we're involved in a huge war in the Middle East? And it would be a huge war if we go at it big time the way Bibi wants. And we discover immediately that we can't do what we think we're going to do in a short period of time. It's the old bugaboo again, you know, air power. Air power is not going to defeat Iran. It's not going to stop their nuclear program. It's not going to defeat them. So you wind up with a choice. You either invade or you stop. And that's not much of a choice. Very bad choice, as a matter of fact.
And my understanding is the Pentagon was always reticent. They did not want... They blocked, there was a huge push in the interim between Bush and Obama to go to war with Iran. And my understanding, you know more about it than I do. My understanding is the Pentagon just said, absolutely not.
They are saying that now, but you wonder how long that resistance can hold up if the president of the United States is intent on, and this is the one place where Trump really worries me, doing everything in his power for Israel. And Trump has made it quite clear that that's his policy. That's his belief. And I think he's being honest about it. Of course, there's the AIPAC business and the money involved. And Trump is, if anything, Trump is a transactional, I want the money man. But I think he's committed to it in a way that Miriam Adelson, for example, indicates in the amount of money that she
gave. Yeah, this is his largest donor, I think $100 million. Is that right?
Yeah.
What would be the difference then between a Trump administration vis-a-vis Israel and a Biden administration? It can't get any worse for the Palestinians in Gaza.
I agree with you. There was, I think, and perhaps this is applicable on the other side too, but there was some political space opening up for Harris. I think she was made aware, vividly aware, of how much the Gaza policy, if you will, with regard to the Biden administration had harmed them. I would say it probably lost them almost a quarter of the progressives that would have voted for him otherwise, particularly in some of the battleground states, key states. And that political space opening up might have changed policy with her somewhat. I'm not saying it would be a volte face, but I am saying it might have been a more mellow policy with regard to Israel and a harder policy on Netanyahu and a complicit policy. And we could do this if we wanted to get him out of there. We have the power to get him out of there if we wanted to use it. He's his own worst enemy in that regard, but we're not. We're not doing that. We're leaving him in there, partly because we know that those around him who might replace him would be just as bad as he, but with maybe a little bit better record and a little bit better outlook on things, especially getting the hostages back. And we've got some hostages that are left alive there, too. That political space would have given her room, I think, to change policy somewhat, to mellow our policy a little bit. I don't think Trump will do that. I think Trump is in for a penny, in for a pound for Israel. And that's dangerous.
I want to talk about what a war with Iran would look like. The Iranian Air Force, as I understand, is pretty decrepit, not very effective, outdated fighters, many going all the way back to the Shah. I don't know what their air defenses are like. Certainly it would start out as an aerial bombing campaign. Would it look like the bombing campaign that we carried out under the Clinton administration against Iraq?
It's not going to look anything like that. In fact, it's going to look quite different, and it's principally because of China, but more so Russia. I think the Israelis in this last attempt, they're lying about it now, and I have that from very good sources. They're lying about it. They're propagandizing it. They didn't do any damage at all to speak of to Iran. And the reason they didn't was because they ran into a buzzsaw of Russian-provided air defense systems. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to read the radars. They didn't know how to jam the radars. Their suppression of enemy air defense, SEED, did not work. They took a few out, but it didn't work enough to where the pilots thought they could go any further. So they launched all their missiles, as I think was the plan originally for the first echelon after the SEED got through, from outside Iran. They were deterred from going inside, and they would be deterred again. And there's every reason to believe that there might be some S-400s as well as S-300s on the ground. And the S-400, sorry, Lockheed Martin, sorry, Raytheon, consumed by Lockheed Martin, is the best air defense system in the world. That's another thing that's happening right now that's disturbing our defense contractors. Chinese and Russian equipment is outdoing in Ukraine and in the Middle East American equipment, which is three or four times as expensive. One of the reasons India is back with Russia again for its armaments and such, despite what our protests are. So we're looking at a situation where we will think that aerial will be all we'll have to do, that is to say bombing. Israel's going to think that. Israel really can't do anything other than bomb Iran, ballistic missiles and bombing, air-launched cruise missiles and such as that. It's not going to do it. It's simply not going to work. There'll be some damage done. There'll be some toll in Tehran and elsewhere in the outlying territories where the nuclear facilities are and such. But it's not going to work. So what do you do then? I've war gamed this. I war gamed it with the Lieutenant General in the Marine Corps, who took great censure from his own buddies in the Pentagon. He was retired at the time, but he used to be my boss when I was down at Quantico to War College. And he said we would lose. He ran the war game two times just to prove that the computers were not wrong. I think he's right. I think one of the things the Iranians will do is take out a U.S. aircraft carrier. That's 5,000 U.S. souls on the bottom of the sea or in the water. And incidentally, we now have so few escorts for our CVs, our aircraft carriers. Let's say there are 2,000 sailors in the water. We couldn't rescue them all because we don't have berth space on the escort ships. Interesting development there. We can't even man some of our ships because we're so short in terms of recruiting. I think it would be a disaster. And what do we do when we get into a disaster like that? It's America. We don't back away. We don't retrench. We don't check our six and look around and say, maybe we made an error. We double down. That's what we'll do. And then it will be a full-fledged war. And if you liked Iraq and you liked Afghanistan, Iran will top $10 trillion, take 10 years to pacify, if it's even moderately pacified, and cost a fortune in blood and treasure.
You're talking about ground forces going in?
That's the only way you rid the country of a nuclear.
Yeah, that's true. But where do they go in from, Iraq? Where would the ground troops go in from? I have a hard time believing the Iraqi government, which is allied with Iran and Shia.
We are illegal under international law and under our own domestic law. We are illegally present in Syria right now.
Yeah, that's true.
We're there protecting oil going to Israel.
That's right. Which Trump said got him in a lot of trouble, but yeah. It was an honest statement.
Yeah. And we would go through Syria without batting an eye.
No.
Israel, Syria.
Yeah, I see. Let's talk about Israel from a military perspective, because you know so much more about this than I do. How do you look at Israel in the Middle East from a strategic point of view as a U.S. ally?
As a total liability. A strategic liability of the first order. And right now, this moment right now, I would say Ukraine notwithstanding, they're the greatest strategic liability we have.
Explain why. Why?
Because there's no positivity to it. Everything is us. Nothing is them.
We took out a lot of those missiles coming in from Iran.
We did, and we depleted our supplies to the point now where I'm not sure even if we decided we were going to do a major aerial attack on Iran, we wouldn't run out of munitions very shortly.
And the genocide. I mean, don't we apply? I think we supply 68% at this point of munitions to sustain the genocide in Gaza.
Is
that correct?
At least that much. If you look at the entire panoply of things we've given Israel, I'd say Gideon Levy at Haaretz is right when he says you share 50-50 responsibility for every death in Gaza, and for that matter, in Lebanon too.
How do you see it playing out in Gaza? I've actually been in the Middle East quite a bit in the last year, in Egypt twice, spent much of the summer in Jordan, was in Qatar, was in the West Bank. And everything I can glean, Israel, of course, wants to push them into the Sinai. And the Egyptian military, I was told by Egyptian journalists in Cairo, has just been adamant, has told Sisi that there's no way a Palestinian is, in fact, according to them, if Israel attempts to push the Palestinians into the Sinai and Sisi accepts them, he's finished. That's what they said. But how do you see it playing out? We know what Israel's intent is, which is, of course, depopulating, annexing northern Gaza. They're largely towards that goal, creating a humanitarian crisis in the south. But eventually, ethnic cleansing, these genocidal tactics are now increasingly being used in the West Bank. How do you see it going? The U.S. must be completely aware of what Israel's intent is, but where do you see that developing?
There are two sets of thoughts, I think, or beliefs, strategic goals in the U.S., and it depends on what body of people you're talking about. Are you talking about Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, and a host of others, Lindsey Graham? Or are you talking about saner people, I would say, on the other side of the aisle, or even in the Republican Party? They think that Israel is doing our job for us. As Bibi Netanyahu is wont to say, if Israel was not killing or ridding the region of these Arabs, Palestinian or otherwise, we'd have to be doing it. He's doing our dirty work for us. He even has said that publicly. The other side says, no, Israel is our ally and our friend, and we have to stand by them, no matter how heinous Bibi is, and he's doing what he needs to do. And then there's the group that I belong to, I think, that says this is horrible what we're doing. And we all warned about this. In the military, we warned about this. David Petraeus even testified to Congress one day and let it slip that Israel was a greater liability than a strategic asset. And maybe we ought to think about rearranging the relationship. After that got out, of course, he walked those remarks back, as David is wont to do. But the military understands how much a strategic liability Israel truly is, especially down in the ranks where people have actually had a chance to look at it, to study it, to look at the history and to understand what's happened and to understand the real history of it, which is often propagandized by the Israelis and the U.S. for consumption by the public.
You heard excerpts from a 54-minute conversation between the former war reporter Chris Hedges and Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. They spoke on November 7, 2024, in one of the first incisive assessments of the U.S. election 2 days earlier. They analyzed what a Trump presidency may look like outside of the borders of America. Find and watch the conversation for free by searching YouTube for the title The World According to Trump with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Wilkerson is a Vietnam War veteran and director of the Marine Corps War College at Quantico. His disillusionment with the trajectory of U.S. foreign policy focused on the secretive decision-making by the Bush administration that led to the invasion of Iraq. Wilkerson has said that the speech Colin Powell made before the United Nations on February 5, 2003, which laid out the case for war with Iraq, included falsehoods of which he and Powell had never been made aware. Wilkerson said, quote, I participated in a hoax on the American people, the international community, and the United Nations. Since then, Wilkerson taught at the College of William and Mary and George Washington University. Chris Hedges currently writes a weekly column at SharePost and hosts the program The Chris Hedges Report on YouTube. He's also the author of over 20 books. Among the most recent are America, The Farewell Tour, and The Greatest Evil is War. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glurden. Thank you for listening.